Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. For this episode, I'm joined by Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey's offices in Pasadena. Ken's been my go-to guy when it comes to earthquake science, and we're going to talk to two of the world's leading experts on what has been described as a ticking seismic time bomb beneath the East Bay, including Oakland and Berkeley, the Hayward Fault. Ken, welcome once again to Blue Dot, and tell us why the Hayward Fault has drawn such attention from the geological community.
For starters, it's part of the San Andreas Fault system. It's a fault that runs along the east side of the Bay Area through a very urban area. As you mentioned, that's really why it has drawn a lot of attention. It has a slip rate that's lower than the San Andreas, but it seems to have earthquakes pretty frequently. And as we'll be hearing from one of our guests, there's a lot that's been figured out from digging into the Hayward Fault. And it basically just seems to all keep indicating, the more data that my colleagues get, that, that it's been a while, and the time that it's been since the most recent big earthquake there is about equal to the average recurrence interval. So you're going to hear more about that.
And of course, the last one was 150 years ago this year, 1868. And that's kind of the focus of our program today, isn't it?
Yeah. And so you'll hear from our other guest about that 1868 earthquake. And sort of course, it occurs to people like, well, what if an earthquake that size were to happen today? Because things have changed. It's gotten a lot more built up.
Well, let's get to our first guest, David Schwartz. He's a geologist emeritus for the United States Geological Survey at Menlo Park and an expert on the Hayward Fault. David, welcome to Blue Dot. Could you please just give me a little geography lesson? Give me a tour of where the Hayward Fault begins, where it passes through, and where it ends. Where is it in relation to the rest of the Bay Area? Because a lot of our listeners probably don't know that.
All right. Well, the Hayward Fault, the southern end, is east of San Jose, and it passes through the cities of Fremont, Hayward, Oakland, Berkeley, El Cerrito, and it extends into San Pablo Bay on the north side of the main Bay Area. And then probably under the bay, it links up with the Rogers Creek Fault, which heads up to Santa Rosa.
Ken, how is that fault system in the Bay Area with the San Andreas and the Hayward and the other faults in that area? How is that different from the system that goes through the rest of California?
You know, there are some strong similarities, actually. That's what occurs to me first instead of differences. If you take the San Andreas system in the San Francisco Bay Area and kind of flip it, mirror image it, to Southern California and look at where the big event happened on the San Andreas and how these sub-parallel faults like the Hayward Fault are related to the San Andreas. Down here, we have some similar faults like the San Jacinto Fault and Elsinore Fault and Newport-Englewood-Rose Canyon Fault System. These are all kind of sub-parallel to the San Andreas. So I think of it as a pretty strong similarity that we have north and south. And of course,
I would say that actually one of the differences is that in the Bay Area, the major faults are closer together, and in Southern California, they're spaced more widely apart. So we've got to deal with the San Gregorio Fault, the San Andreas Fault, the Calaveras, the Hayward, the Concord Green Valley, the Greenville, and a big active thrust fault under Mount Diablo, which is very close to where I live. And actually, as we're doing this interview, I can look out of my home office window and see Mount Diablo. So we have, probably in the Bay Area, we have the highest density of active faults per square mile of any place in the country.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a great point. And since you mentioned what you're seeing out the window, you've also been getting rattled and your neighbors have been looking to you for, hey, what's going on, David? But a lot of activity happening.
Yeah, we live in an area. Danville's located in the San Ramon Valley, and it's sort of the home base of earthquake swarms for the Bay Area. And these are basically bunches of earthquakes that occur on a really short fault. Could last a few days or a month or more, produce tens or hundreds of earthquakes, and then just turn off. And none of these swarms has ever turned into something large, but they really create a high anxiety level among the population, and they're just really a reminder of the larger earthquakes that lie out ahead of us.
Some of the structures that get active in these swarms are not necessarily the faults that parallel the San Andreas, like we were talking about the Hayward and some of the others that are almost paralleling. But then you mentioned Mount Diablo, and you know, there are some really interesting other fault geometries going on in that area, aren't there?
Yeah, well, in addition to Mount Diablo with the thrust fault, and you've got thrust faults actually a lot more than we do in Southern California.
That's what I see out my window, by the way. Yeah.
Can we just take a moment and please explain to us the difference between a thrust fault that you just mentioned and the type of fault that the Hayward or the San Andreas is? Give us a little earthquake 101 on these different types of faults.
What we have going on in Southern California, we call it the Big Bend, and the San Andreas Fault, for some parts of its length throughout the state, is well aligned for plate tectonic movement between the North American and Pacific plates. So things go along in a right lateral strike slip way, pretty copacetic without a whole lot of compression or extension. But in the Big Bend, it's misaligned, and so we have compression across it. So we have thrust faults. Those have been responsible for the 1971 and 1994 earthquakes that were both heavily damaging in LA. So that compression is giving rise literally to the mountains, the whole transverse ranges in Southern California. And so I think, David, similarly, when you look out, you're looking at Mount Diablo, also a thrust, but you have a different geometry going on up there.
Yeah, we do. And one thing to point out is when we use terms like strike slip fault and thrust fault, a strike slip fault is a fault where two sides of the crust move laterally past each other. So if a fault went through a road in front of your house and you were looking up the road and it was displaced or offset by the fault movement, you'd have to step to your right to continue. And that right lateral strike slip is what most of these major faults are. Thrust faults are faults that extend into the crust at an angle, 45 degrees, 50 degrees, and one side moves up and over the other. And it's this upward movement that creates the mountains behind the thrust fault. With strike slip faults, there is no vertical change. And so the overall geography of strike slip fault zones is quite a bit different.
So if I build a fence across one of these right lateral strike slip faults like the Hayward or the San Andreas, my fence will go across and make a jog to the right as I look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a great photograph from the 1906 earthquake that shows exactly that. And I know one of the points that you take away, David, and your colleagues, is that in the background of that photograph, there are some buildings that are not very far from the fault, and there's no evidence that those buildings were damaged. So even though we may have a lot of slip on a fault like the San Andreas in the 1906 earthquake, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be heavy damage all along that fault rupture. In general, the shaking is stronger along a fault, but the fault rupture itself, of course, can be very disruptive to lifelines, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we have, I mean, there are two types of damage that we worry about. One is from direct damage to a structure that sits on top of the fault. And when that fault moves, you know, it doesn't bode well in general for buildings on top of it. And then second is the shaking, you know, and that extends over a much, much broader zone. So in general, fault traces are very narrow. One of the more interesting large ruptures that occurred in the U.S. is the 2002 Denali earthquake in Alaska. And that ruptured the ground for over 200 miles. It moved the crust sideways about 27 feet. And it went underneath the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which actually had been designed to accommodate the movement. They designed it for 20 feet of movement, and in 2002, the Denali Fault moved 15 feet under the pipeline. So it was good. But there were places where I could stand and have that fault go directly between my legs with 24 to 27 feet of movement sideways along it. So these faults in many ways are, they're cracks in the Earth's crust, and they extend down to 6, 7, 8, 9 miles before the physical properties of the crust change. And, you know, there's a popular Hollywood kind of version of the fault moves, and there are great gaping crevasses and buildings topple in and dinosaurs pop out. And it's the farthest thing from the truth. Shaking can cause a lot of secondary type of ground failures, but in general, faults themselves are pretty narrow. And that's one of the reasons we can actually go out and put trenches across them and get their history, because it's all in one spot.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlum. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with David Schwartz, USGS Geologist Emeritus, on the anatomy and history of the Hayward Fault. Stay with us. And we're back. I'm once again joined by Ken Hudnut from the USGS, and let's return to our conversation with David Schwartz, Geologist Emeritus from the USGS Menlo Park office in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think I mentioned to Ken one time before that wouldn't it be awesome to be able to get a view from above, like from a drone, doing high definition fast motion photography of what it would look like when one of these faults actually breaks, to see that in real time.
I think that would be fantastic. I mean, I would actually like to see that myself. And I've had dreams of watching a fault rupture. So after doing this for 43, 44 years, you know, it's just something you'd like to see. I wouldn't like to see the effects of that earthquake, but I'd love to see the actual fault move.
Yeah, the rupture going by. We interviewed the elder of the Cucapá tribe down in Mexico after he personally witnessed the fault rupture going past him in 2010. So his nickname was Chayos, but Rosario. He gave us the most wonderful interview of what he saw, and he compared the crack front going past him to what it looked like to him when the four-wheel drives go racing by in the Baja Big Challenge race, and they go across Laguna Salada, and a big dust plume kicks up. So he described it that way. It looked to him like that. And so, you know, there have been people that witnessed rupture. I think, David, you probably know better than I, the Bora Peak, the people that witnessed that rupture as well.
Yeah, there were a number of people who witnessed the rupture of the Lost River Fault in Idaho in 1983. And this is a normal fault. It's sort of the reverse of a thrust fault. One side goes up relative to the other, but the type of angle is a little different. And if you go out into Nevada and Idaho and Utah, the ranges, the mountain ranges, are all bounded by these normal faults. Anyway, in 1983, the Lost River Fault moved to produce a magnitude 6.9 earthquake. And there was one woman who described the rupture. She said it was like a white ribbon extended across the landscape and just kept moving off in the distance. And then there were a couple of hunters who had been obviously out drinking all night, and they were sitting in their truck right in front of the fault. And as the fault, the earth started to move, part of it initially dropped down and then popped up with this 9-foot-high wall of gravel and sand, which was the what we call the fault scarp, the actual trace of the fault. They had no idea what they were looking at, and they had no idea whether or not they were actually going to make it.
Amazing.
Wow.
When we were over in Wenchuan, China area, where they had the 2008 earthquake, we had the opportunity to talk to some of the people that survived that and witness the fault rupture come through. And one woman, where she experienced it, she was thrown to the ground and basically saw the rupture forming. And it all kind of happened in a, it was difficult to tell exactly what had happened, but it was very traumatic for her. And another gentleman said he saw the rupture go through and offset the road that we were standing on as we talked with him. And also it took down the building that we were standing next to. So just a number of people also witnessed that earthquake rupture go right through.
And it happens really fast, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, I forget offhand, Ken, you might remember the speed at which the rupture actually moves along the ground surface.
Yeah. It may sound incredible, but when you convert the S-wave velocity, the surface rupture probably cracks at the surface at about that velocity of a few kilometers per second. And, it, you know, when you convert the units, it's about 7,000 miles per hour, which might seem incredible. You know, it's probably slower than that because at the surface we get into the softer soils that probably slows it down a bit. But, you know, it's moving right along.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio from Northern California. I'm joined by my friend Ken Hudnut from the USGS in Pasadena. And we're talking to geologist emeritus from the USGS in Menlo Park, David Schwartz. David, I'd like to kind of close out with finding a little bit more about you. You've talked about trenching across the faults. How do you go about actually studying a fault like the Hayward Fault? How do you go about digging these trenches to determine what has happened in the past and what that can teach us about what may happen in the future?
Basically, what we do is we locate where the fault is. We get a backhoe and we excavate a trench. That can be anywhere from 3 to 15 feet deep, and that may not sound like it's very deep, but if, when you're in a 15-foot deep trench looking up, you know, there's sort of a slit of light above you. We drop in shores or jacks and pump them up to hold the walls open. And then we get out our scrapers, and little hand scrapers, and begin to scrape walls until they're perfectly clean. And in doing that, this brings out all of the deposits that are there, and it brings out the traces of the fault that are going through these different deposits. And then we do a very, very careful map of the trench wall. And these days we do this with various types of photography. And then very, very carefully record the different types of deposits. What happens is when a fault ruptures, it breaks to the surface. And it deforms the surface. And if that location is a place where younger deposits come in, they can bury this distortion of the ground surface. So in effect, the rupture becomes a fossil. And then the fault breaks again, and it breaks to the new ground surface. And then it's buried again, and it breaks to a higher ground surface. So we can see these old ground surfaces in the trench, and using different techniques like carbon-14 dating, we can date when the fault broke to that previous or older ground surface. And we try and go back and see how many earthquakes we can record in the trench. And we use this information on the frequency of past events to say something about the likelihood of what may occur in the future. So it's really, it's very archaeological in a way, and it's labor-intensive, and, you know, the more experience you get, the better you become at doing it, and the better results we can provide to the public and everyone else.
So you're like Indiana Jones, but no crazy French guy trying to come steal your stuff.
Well, sometimes, you know, the competition between different geologists to get the answer first almost leads to that. But in general, we're pretty collegial.
You know, I was just thinking about the Hayward Fault, and you mentioned how it's your seismic star and some of that work that you've mentioned. It really, you know, going back 1900 years and finding evidence for 12 earthquakes. You mentioned about recurrence interval. I want to make sure people understand what you mean in that, using that term. But, you know, these results from the Hayward Fault are rather spectacular and really stand out on the global scale when you talk about paleoseismology and significance of the results for helping to portend the future and forecast what might happen next. But with the Hayward, you know, maybe just tell people more about the 1868 earthquake and the ones before it, and what does that tell us?
From the paleoseismological studies, the past five earthquakes have had an average recurrence or an average repeat time of 131 years. For the past nine earthquakes, that average has been 150 years. And for the past 12 earthquakes, almost a 2,000-year record, it's averaged 160 years. So however you look at it, the recurrence interval is really short. If we say it's 160 years, 150 years, we are now coming up on the 150th anniversary of the 1868 event. So there's uncertainty in our numbers, but in the bigger picture, we're closer to the next large earthquake than further away.
And on that note, I think that's an excellent place to end this interview. Thank you so much for talking to us today, David Schwartz.
You're very welcome.
Thanks to David Schwartz, USGS Geologist Emeritus. He joined us from his home in the Bay Area. Next up, Ken and I are going to talk to Tom Broker. So, Ken Hudnut from Pasadena, give us a thumbnail sketch on the career of Tom Broker. Why is he the go-to guy to talk to about Hayward Fault?
Well, Tom is a seismologist and uses seismic waves to image what's underneath the Earth's surface. So taking energy from, say, naturally occurring earthquakes or maybe explosions or air guns from behind a boat, they put that energy down in and then record it coming out and then put all that data together. It's kind of like medical imaging, like an MRI, that kind of thing. Same idea. So Tom has done that kind of imagery work of the subsurface for the San Francisco Bay Area. He also was leader of the Earthquake Science Center at USGS during the South Napa earthquake response. So he wrote a wonderful summary paper on that earthquake in SRL. So he's been an important scientific leader and also has brought together a lot of information about the 1868 earthquake, which was the last big earthquake on the Hayward Fault.
Well, let's talk to him. So, Tom Broker, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start out with some origin questions for you. When did you first get interested in the science of seismology and earthquakes?
I got interested in earthquakes in 1974 when I was a junior at the University of Michigan. there aren't many earthquakes in Michigan, but there are some in Ohio. So I actually spent my senior year working on a project to help locate seismic stations that were going to be installed in Ohio to monitor the earthquakes there.
When did you experience your first really, you know, your good earthquake experience? What was the first one of those?
Well, my first really big earthquake was the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, San Francisco Bay Area, which I was on the third floor of a three-story building, and we were about 12, 15 miles from the epicenter, and the walls were moving back, it looked to me, about a foot side to side. And everything came off my bookshelves, and everything came off my desk, and there was a pile of about 1 foot high of debris after the earthquake stopped.
And a question I have for all people like you, and Ken included, is when you experienced that, were you frightened, or were you just excited that you're experiencing this phenomenon that you're so embedded in studying?
Oh, I was definitely frightened. It was scary for me because every earthquake I'd been in before that, by the time you felt the shaking usually, that was the peak of the shaking, and the shaking usually just decreased with time. But this earthquake, the Loma Prieta earthquake, every new wave that came in was bigger than the last one had been. And the waves just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I just thought, well, when are these waves going to stop getting bigger and bigger? And I was thinking, well, I hope this building stands up. And about that time is when the shaking started to get smaller with each new wave. And the building actually did pretty well. There was just very minor damage to some of the ceiling tiles. But it was definitely not an experience where I was cool and dispassionate.
Yeah, I would say same here for me. Instead of saying my first earthquake experience, I'd like to share my most intense, which was the Northridge earthquake of 94. And for me, I was in my office here in Pasadena. And I was, which may seem odd because people that know, that was an earthquake in the very early morning. So I was doing an all-nighter working on revisions to a paper here. And so when the earthquake hit, it was very sudden, very strong jolting back and forth. And I knew from talking to one of my USGS colleagues from his experience in Loma Prieta that he had gotten under a desk, and that stuck with me. And so I got under my desk when the Northridge earthquake hit, and I did basically drop, cover, hold on, although at that time we didn't refer to it that way. That's with all the drills we do every year now. But that's what I did, and then it did intensify like Tom was describing, and it got really crazy, and I was not enjoying it. I was definitely frightened as well. And then before the shaking stopped, and this was probably not such a great idea, but I got out from under the desk and I called my wife. She was at home with our two kids, and somehow, fortunately, I got a call through and found out that they were okay. So that was very reassuring. But yeah, the experience was way too intense to feel any kind of like scientific exciting at the time. That came later, but you know, yeah. And it just was real interesting to hear Tom talk about his experience there at Loma Prieta.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. When we come back, Ken Hudnut and I will continue our conversation with USGS seismologist Tom Broker as we discuss the past and future of earthquakes on the Hayward Fault. Stay with us. And we're back. I'm Dave Shlom, joined this week by Ken Hudnut from the USGS in Pasadena. Let's continue now with our interview with USGS Menlo Park seismologist Tom Broker as we talk about the Hayward Fault. Mine was in 1971. I lived in Northridge, and that was the Sylmar San Fernando earthquake of February 9th, early in the morning. And I remember we lived near train tracks, and at first I thought, oh, it's a train coming. And then, I was half asleep, and then it was like, well, this train's coming into the house. Something's terribly wrong. And then I remember I had these model World War II airplanes hanging from monofilament line on this acoustic ceiling in my, 11-year-old boy's room. And those airplanes were just swinging wildly and smashing into the roof. And I remember at the time my thought was, oh, damn, my planes are going to break. And I was more worried about the planes than anything else. And then I started to, as the shaking got more intense, I started to really get frightened because I had no idea what was going on. And that really was the beginning of my personal fascination with earthquakes.
I have a few of my colleagues that study earthquakes to this day that experienced that same earthquake, and I think it was also formative for them. I think one of the things we are challenged by in trying to help people to understand the earthquake threat is a lot of younger people did not experience any of these earthquakes that we're talking about. I hate to say, but we're kind of the old people around, and young people maybe can't quite relate to just how severe, how frightening a big earthquake can be, especially if you're in close to a moderate to large earthquake. It's not fun. I don't think that any of the people that I've talked to that were in the red zone shaking for a larger earthquake have felt fun was at all part of that experience.
Well, I remember shortly after that, a friend of our family who's a geologist told me the next time you drive through Highway 14 on your way to Bishop up to Highway 395 from LA, I want you to look at Palmdale and look at the side of the road there. Look at this road cut and see if you see the twisted rock there. And I found it when we were on our way through there. And he said, now, think about those are the forces that twist that rock that cause these earthquakes where we live. And once I checked that out and looked at that, and it's, of course, a famous road cut now. Lots of geology students have seen it, the twisted strata there at Palmdale. That scared the hell out of me. And again, also led to my fascination with earthquakes. I'd like to talk to you both about this year being the 150th anniversary of a very important earthquake in California history that most of us are not aware of. And that was what happened in 1868 on October 21st. And that's the Hayward earthquake. So could you, Tom, tell us a bit about that. Just give us a historical perspective on that earthquake.
Well, that earthquake happened just a few years after the Civil War had ended, and the Bay Area had exploded with the gold rush. But still, the population back in 1868 was only about 250,000 people in the whole Bay Area. And in the East Bay Area, along the Hayward Fault, there were probably only 15,000 people living along it at the time. And now the population is like 30 times bigger in the Bay Area. And we have many, many more people who are living along the Hayward Fault. Back in the day of that earthquake, Hayward was a little tiny town of about 500 people. And so was San Leandro, which was also very heavily damaged by that earthquake, also had about 500 people. And there, but San Leandro had the county courthouse, which was an unreinforced masonry building, and it was very heavily damaged. It was a two-story courthouse, and the jail was underneath in the basement, and that was very heavily damaged. And in fact, somebody trying to run out of that building was killed by the stones falling on top of him as he tried to to leave. The earthquake did a lot of damage in San Francisco as well, which is right across the bay. And at that time, it was called the Great San Francisco Earthquake. And it was the biggest earthquake that had ever occurred in the Bay Area until that time.
Did something happen in 1906 that, you know, changed that?
The Great San Francisco Earthquake that we know of as the Great San Francisco Earthquake happened in 1906. And that was about 10 times bigger than the 1868 earthquake. We don't have any, what you'd say, modern seismological measurements of the 1868 earthquake. But from accounts of the damage that were done and how strong the shaking was experienced and its distribution, we've estimated that the magnitude of the 1868 earthquake was about was about 6.8, 6.9 or so, about the same size as the Loma Prieta earthquake.
How do you go about investigating an earthquake like that? Like you said, that's before our modern seismology with seismometers and seismographs where we can measure the magnitude of an earthquake. What kinds of things do you do to really piece that information together for us?
It turns out that there was a commission that was set up after the 1868 earthquake, a commission of scientists to study the earthquake, but their report was never released. And depending on how much you believe in conspiracy theories, there's one school of thought that their report was actually suppressed by people who didn't want the Bay Area to be known as having an earthquake issue. But in any event, the first scientific report of the 1868 earthquake was included in a very famous report in 1908 by Lawson and others on the 1906 earthquake. And so there's a little chapter about the 1868 earthquake in that bigger, much bigger volume about the 1906 earthquake. But mainly what we do is we look at, there are several indicators of how strong the shaking was, or crack form in plaster walls or chimneys broken or even destroyed. Were tombstones thrown down in cemeteries, and information like that. And that, we assign a score. It's called a modified Mercalli intensity to those observations. And I forget how many observations we had from 1868, but I think we had about 100, maybe 150 different reports in newspapers mainly, but sometimes in letters people wrote. And so we're able to make a pretty good map of the distribution of the level of shaking from that earthquake. We can also look at some leveling data or surveying data to see how much displacement of the fault there may have been at that time. It's not, Ken's a specialist and an expert in using research-grade GPS data to look at displacements from faults. But prior to that, back in the 1860s, there would have been surveyor data before and after the earthquake that give us some idea of the amount of motion that earthquake caused.
Ken, I'd like to get your take, what you'd like to know about this from Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm looking here at the nice USGS fact sheet that you took the lead on, Tom, and it has a really nice comparison in it showing the shake map that you and your colleagues have pieced together for the 1868 earthquake, and it also shows the shake map for the Loma Prieta 1989 earthquake. And there are some similarities and some differences. Each of those had an area of very intense shaking, but then that shaking drops off with distance. Maybe, are there some points that occur to you in making a comparison between 1868 and 1989?
That's a good point, Ken. The main take-home from that comparison of shake maps, or the intensities of shaking that were seen in the Loma Prieta earthquake versus the 1868 Hayward earthquake is that the high levels of shaking that we saw in the Loma Prieta earthquake were largely restricted to the Santa Cruz Mountains south of the Bay Area proper, closer to Santa Cruz, which was heavily damaged, than Watsonville south of the Bay Area, whereas a Hayward Fault earthquake will produce very strong shaking right in the heart of the Bay Area, in the East Bay particularly, but will also be strongly felt in San Jose and parts of the San Francisco that jut farthest to the east. And we'll see very strong levels of shaking from that Hayward Fault earthquake in the East Bay, where something like 2 million of us live and work. The other point is that the aftershocks from a Hayward Fault earthquake will be also be right in the heart of the Bay Area, whereas those in the Loma Prieta earthquake were more focused in the Santa Cruz Mountains, farther from the core of the Bay Area itself. And so we'll have very strong damaging aftershocks right in the heart of the Bay Area as well. And I guess a final kind of comparison between those two earthquakes is that we looked and we really never actually found cracking on the ground produced by the main fault plane of the fault that was responsible for the Loma Prieta earthquake. Whereas in the Hayward Fault, we expect to see that ground cracking come up right up to the surface. But what's really interesting, and as you know well from studying the Napa earthquake back in 2014, is that much of the slip that we'll see, much of the motion that we'll see on the surface of the Hayward Fault might actually come after days and weeks, maybe even months, following the main earthquake that produces the Hayward earthquake. And so we expect that infrastructure that crosses the Hayward Fault, it might be okay the day of the earthquake and maybe even the first few days, but over time, the amount of stretching of that crack, the lengthening of that crack at the surface along the Hayward Fault will grow and grow and grow, and over time, you might expect to see more and more issues with infrastructure being stretched too far and breaking. So that's one thing to keep an eye on following a Hayward Fault earthquake.
Yeah, that concerns me too, Dave. Just so you know, this is we learn from each earthquake, and the Napa earthquake certainly taught us that the fault can move and then keep moving. Tom, I wanted to, if I could, circle back. And when you talked about the shaking patterns seen in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, one thing that does stick out, as scientists, we're always looking for that observation that doesn't quite fit. And so in that case, I know that you and your colleagues working on that earthquake saw that the ground motions were especially strong in the Marina District where there was damage, and also where the Cypress structure collapsed. And there's a bit of red there, and I know this has to do with mud, so I just thought I would elicit a little bit more from you on that.
Yeah, there were two kind of, as Ken noted, there were kind of two kind of hot spots up in well north of the Loma Prieta epicenter. One was in the San Francisco and the Marina District, and then one was over Oakland, actually, was fairly widespreadly shaken hard. And a couple things were responsible, we think. First is that the Marina was landfill. It was built at the time that they were preparing for the 1915 exposition in San Francisco. And So that shook harder. And also the Cyprus structure was built on a place of where the soils were very weak and soft. But there was another cause, which was that the strong shaking from the earthquake actually went down, travels in all directions away from the epicenter like a stone thrown in a pond. But some of the waves actually went downward, and they got reflected from the base of the continental crust down around 20 miles, so it bounced back upward, and it arrived at about the same time as the waves traveling horizontally along the surface in the Marina District and in the Oakland area. And so those two waves merged together and became larger and produced stronger levels of shaking than we saw in other parts of the Bay Area proper.
So that's like constructive interference of waves, where the waves coincide with each other, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's what happens, we think.
I'd like to know briefly, how much have we done since 1989? Because it's not really shaking that kills anyone. It's collapsing buildings and in infrastructure problems with our buildings and our structures. What have we done? What are the major things that we've done to prepare to get our buildings better and safer, seismically safer, since 1989 to now? What have we done?
Oh, we've done a lot. California Department of Transportation has strengthened all the overpasses and the elevated freeways so that they don't have a superstructure type collapse. Hospitals have been either rebuilt or retrofit so that they are not only, don't fall down during earthquakes, but they will be functional after the earthquakes so that they can be useful. BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, has done a lot of retrofitting of its train stations and its train tracks. A lot of the city halls and the city infrastructure, fire stations and police stations and so on, have been retrofit or rebuilt so that they'll be capable of being functional following earthquakes. There's been a lot of individuals who have retrofit their own properties. The city of San Francisco has passed an ordinance to require the retrofitting of what we call soft story, three and four story buildings, which have kind of a lot of garages or shop windows on the first story, and so they're structurally weaker. So engineers call them soft stories. So they're required to be retrofit in San Francisco, and I think if couple other places in San Francisco. A lot of the older unreinforced masonry buildings have either been torn down or retrofit. So really a lot has been done. I should mention that the water utilities have strengthened their crossings of the various faults in the Bay Area, including those across the Hayward Fault. So I think we can be proud of the work that has been done, which is not to say that we're done and that we can stop now, but there has been a lot of work to make a lot of our critical infrastructure more resilient to earthquakes.
Yeah, I've seen an estimate. This was through KQED reporting at one of the recent anniversaries of the Loma Prieta earthquake, but they tallied it up to over $50 billion worth of infrastructure improvements. One of the tunnels you mentioned, the Claremont Tunnel, East Bay Mud, they made it so that when the Hayward Fault slips in a future earthquake, it'll be able to handle that fault slip without having problematic disruption to the water flow. And, of course, there's the Bay Bridge as a great example of major infrastructure investment in recognition of how important it is for people to be able to get back and forth.
Right. And that's just one of the bridges, of the toll bridges, that's either been retrofit or replaced. They've all been retrofit to some degree, and even the Golden Gate Bridge has been retrofit, and PG&E has replaced a lot of the pipes that are in softer liquefiable soils with more flexible pipes that will do better, fare better during earthquakes.
The CEO from PG&E and I had a chance to talk one time, and she was telling me that their substations, they changed out the insulators from the old brittle ceramic type to a type that could handle the shaking better. And when the South Napa earthquake hit, they had much less trouble because they attributed it to that program of doing those upgrades. So it really worked out well for them.
Well, we're about out of time, but it does feel to me like a looming examination that all of our preparations will be facing. And as you guys like to say, it's not a matter of if, but when.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Tom Broker, thank you for joining us on Blue Dot. It's fascinating to hear your take on our earthquake science and especially the Hayward Fault.
Well, thank you very much for having me and informing people about the Hayward Fault. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to our guests, David Schwartz, geologist emeritus, and Tom Broker, seismologist, both from the United States Geological Survey in Menlo Park. And thanks to my guest host, Ken Hudnut from the USGS in Pasadena. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org. Subscribe via NPR Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.